Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Hi, Fred. Welcome to the studio. This is live.
Yeah, this is exciting.
We're going to go through emails that have been sent to us from people listening. This has become, I think, the most popular regular feature on Bob Enyart Live. Fred, so thank you very much.
It sounds great, Bob.
The Real Science Friday shows are a lot of fun. We invited people to email us their questions, and so we have some great questions, some from evolutionist or creationist, and also people could call at 1-800-8-ENYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. Now, Fred, could you read just the first couple questions before we answer them, okay?
Okay, so here's a question we got from Peter in Littleton, and he was asking, what is the purpose of defense mechanisms before the fall?
Defense mechanisms?
Yeah, such as venomous snakes, spiders, and thorns.
Okay, so some animals have defense mechanisms, and before the fall, they wouldn't have to be defending themselves from carnivores or whatever. So that's a great question. And then there's a question... Oh, about supernova remnants. Remember we talked about those?
Yeah, exactly. We talked about that on our last show.
Yeah, and this guy, his name is Chance. And just summarize it. His questions are a bit lengthy, but summarize it.
Yeah, so Chance is a member of a forum at evolutionfairytale.com. He's a longtime member.
That's your website, evolutionfairytale.com.
And we have a forum there. Mm-hmm. And I posted an article or a topic on our last show about supernova remnants. We also call them SNRs.
When a star blows up, a supernova, there should be a remnant. And the old earthers have a hard time because they can't find enough that have blown up a long time ago.
That's right, because after they explode, they expand. Yeah. This is as you would imagine. But the problem is we don't see enough expansion. They all fit within a younger universe paradigm.
So Chance is saying, hey, you used information from 1976.
Well, I happen to quote an evolutionist from 1976 who asked the question, why have the large number of expected remnants not been detected?
So let's get to that in a little bit. Okay, so those are a couple questions. And again, our phone number is 1-800-8-ENYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. But let's start by going to the phones. In Lansing, Michigan, Fred, welcome to Bob Enyart Live.
Thank you. Hi, Bob. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Fred.
All right.
I've got two questions, and you can take one or the other or both.
All right.
One of them relates to the geologic column. And the other to sickle cell anemia.
Okay, this is going to be fun. I'd like to take both, actually.
Yeah, definitely.
But go ahead, the geologic column, Fred. Ask your question.
All right. Well, we're told that that the sedimentary rocks on Earth are layered in such a way that the simplest organisms are at the bottom, and then subsequent layers have more complicated organisms.
Right.
And I'm wondering if that's true, first of all, that the simpler organisms do tend to get sorted at the bottom.
Okay.
And if so, you know, would the flood and a year's worth of tidal waves and sorting and sifting produce that result? And then are there exceptions to that? Because it seems to me that if... starfish or a vertebrate were to wind up down with the trilobites at the bottom, that would be quite fatal to the whole theory.
Mm. Well, there's a lot of fatal stuff in the real world versus the evolution textbooks. But okay, so Fred from Michigan, what a great question. I see Fred Williams here in the studios chomping at the bit. So Fred, where do we start? Why don't we start with the aspect of this other Fred's question, where the simpler life forms are found at the lowest strata. Could we address that first, how evolutionists say we find simple things simple life way down deep.
Okay. Well, evolutionists, they love to use what I would say is alluring terminology, things like simple and primitive and ancestral, because it gives the illusion of simple to complex.
Right.
But informed evolutionists know that that's not true. At the very bottom of the fossil record, so to speak, in their mythological geologic column,
right,
trilobites are extremely complex creatures. Their eyes are more complex than anything that we have.
Trilobites have, in fact, their eyes can see 360 degrees practically, which is this extraordinary engineering feat. And it's not just their... It's not just that aspect of their body that's extraordinary.
Yeah, I have quotes from evolutionists that just marvel at the complexity of the trilobite eyes. I'm not going to read some of the details that they have, but they do admit things like that they've solved laws of refraction.
Yeah, the difficulties
involved in engineering. Exactly, the complexity of the optics of birefringent crystals, things like that. They believe that that all evolved. Of course, we say that that's so complex, it had to have been created.
Okay, not only a trilobite, but all kinds of single-celled organisms we know are wildly complex today.
Yes.
So that's just the beginning of Fred's question, though.
Yeah, and I just give an example of what evolutionists have said on this. Stephen Jay Gould is widely known evolutionist, and he's informed on this topic. And he said that, "I believe that our failure to find any clear vector of fitfully accumulating progress represents our greatest dilemma for a study of pattern in life's history. What he's admitting to is the fossil record does not show simple to complex.
Simple to complex.
They cannot find that in the fossil
record. It shows wildly complex and wildly complex.
But evolutionists love to say that it goes from simple to complex, even though the informed ones admit that that's not the case.
Okay, now let's talk about the actual geologic column as Fred, because so far we've only addressed the question of simple life, which is a misnomer. So how about the actual geologic column where you find the lowest strata at the bottom and you come toward the top and the more recent strata, and supposedly all the simpler life is at the bottom, and why would it be like that? So where do you want to begin with all that?
Well, I guess I would start with, theoretically, when you look at the geologic column, we really only find it in one place. Do you know where that is, Bob?
No.
Okay, it's in the textbooks.
Oh,
not
in the real world.
You don't find them in the real world. Now, there will be some evolutionists to say, well, wait a minute, North Dakota, we found 10, superseding strata that represent the geologic column. But what they're not telling you is that that's really only about 6% of what should be there if it was the entire geologic
column. How many places in North America have geologists found the strata layers in the wrong orders as what they should be based on the textbook?
Okay. Well, a guy that used to publish frequently in the Creation Research Society Quarterly, a journal that we talk about frequently here, Walter Lammerts, he documented 198 wrong order formations in the United States alone between 84 and 87. These are what evolutionists call overthrusts.
Let me bring Fred from Michigan in on this. Hey, Fred.
Okay. Yes.
Did you hear that in the United States, and this is documented in Creation Research Society Quarterly, there are at least 198 instances where the strata layers of the geologic column are in the wrong order. And so geologists will say, and that, for example, we'll find dinosaur fossils laying on the surface of the earth, like in Nebraska, where there's a state park, dinosaur fossils on the surface. But so geologists will say, yes, but these are overthrusts, right, Fred?
Yeah.
Williams?
Well, my favorite example is the Appalachian Mountains. You know, they found a thin layer of strata beneath the Appalachian Mountains that's actually younger than it's supposed to be. So they had to say, well, somehow the Appalachian Mountains all overthrust over that layer.
Yeah.
Over time, they realized, okay, that's kind of silly. So now they think that it all shifted there over like hundreds of miles.
Yeah. So here's the problem, Fred. To maintain their belief that these represent evolutionary ages, they have to say that massive chunks of North America slid over on top of other chunks. The problem is there are such things as overthrust, right, Fred? We find that around the world. But when you have overthrust, you see the evidence. There's catastrophe like earthquakes and so on. Actually, a lot of this is a result of the flood. But then you see that the one layer scratched and dragged, for example, drug boulders, and they left these marks just like glaciers will do. Well, supposedly we have massive overthrust that left no evidence of any overthrusting, and the layers, the boundaries between the layers, are completely undisturbed and show no scratches whatsoever. So that says, hey, these are not overthrusts.
That's right. You see plenty of examples where evolutionists will even admit in their geologic journals that they're confused by the lack of evidence of any of this scratching.
Right. And so the reason they say that the layer on top is older than the layers underneath is because the layers on top have the fossils that are supposedly evolved into the animals that are in the layers underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's circular reasoning. You say, well, how do you know this layer is this old? Well, because of the fossils we found in it. So it's circular reasoning, and it breaks down. All right.
Yes. And so just one thing to add to Bob,
yes,
on this, and Fred also, is a discovery that was made back in, 2000, that really was a great discovery for creation. And they found a vertebrate in the Cambrian strata. So,
wait, vertebrate? What does that mean? I went
okay
to public school.
Evolutionists claim that invertebrates evolved over time into vertebrates. And for the longest time, they said that was a 100 million year process.
Well, a vertebrate is
something with a backbone. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's
so
right.
It's like not a Democrat.
That
it's not a Republican. No, it's a creature with a backbone. So an invertebrate would be like a jellyfish, for example.
Exactly.
Has no backbone. Okay, so they found a vertebrate. Where did they find
it? In the Cambrian strata, which is supposed to be one of the earliest stratas laid, if you look in the geologic column.
Like
there's a pre-Cambrian. This is like really right at the bottom,
like
pretty
much.
Like
at the bottom of the Grand Canyon.
That's right.
Where they also find pollen from trees.
Yes, that was published in the Creation Research Quarterly also.
See that? I read.
Yeah.
But so they find vertebrates and pollen, what, 100 million years before these creatures evolved.
That's right. And so what it did was it shrank the time for invertebrates to evolve into vertebrates to really to no time. Evolutionists try to say, well, maybe there's 3 million years in there where it could have happened. Well, come on. Genetics, we know that it's just not possible. Yeah. The evolutionist who discovered this in China, they have a little bit more leeway, but he would have never got away with this quote in a published journal, in one of their secular journals. But in the Boston Globe in May 30th of 2000, the evolutionist Chinese scientist who discovered this said, "The emergence of such a sophisticated creature at so early a date show that modern life forms burst on the scene suddenly."
Right.
Of course, that's a creationist expectation.
Right.
He went on to say, "Neo-Darwinism
cannot
account for the sudden emergence of so many new genetic forms." I mean, they found really complex vertebrate creatures in the Cambrian. Boy, what a another big nail in the coffin for evolution, one of many nails in the coffin.
All right. So, Fred, how's that as at least an initial take on your question?
Yeah, no, that's terrific. I'm going to move on to the second one.
Sure.
Okay. Well, back to the geologic column, just one quick one.
Go ahead.
Does the Grand Canyon have all 10 geologic?
No, it doesn't.
Or does it have like half of them, or?
I'm not sure how many it has, but I know it doesn't have the full geologic column. And, you know, many evolutionists, probably not a majority yet, but quite a few now believe that the Grand Canyon is formed by water. I have a friend who's a geologist. That's his profession. He's on the board of Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship.
Wait, by water, they all say it was formed by the water of the Colorado River.
I'm sorry, by a catastrophe, by some kind of water catastrophe.
Right.
They're called neocatastrophists. These evolutionists admit the Grand Canyon had to have been formed by some kind of water disaster.
Because rivers don't form Grand Canyons, and the rivers all over the world.
And Mount St. Helens proved it can happen in a matter of hours.
Right.
And what this friend of mine told me, that geologists that he knows that are evolutionists admit that Mount St. Helens overturned 90% of what we know about geology because of what it did in such a remarkably short period of time.
Right. And Fred, in Michigan, by the way, there's a new chapter of Walt Brown's book. It's available on the internet at creationscience.com. And he gives a description of how the Grand Canyon formed that's just extraordinary. But okay, so did we answer that question?
You knocked it out of the park.
All right. Now, what's your second question? Then we'll go to Steve in Denver.
Okay. Second question relates to sickle cell anemia. The evolutionists are always looking for positive or beneficial mutations, and that seems to be kind of hard. So they'll point to sickle cell anemia, and here's my quick understanding and then my question. My understanding is if two adults have sickle cell trait, which is not so bad, there then one out of approximately 25% of their offspring could have sickle cell anemia, which is more
more devastating.
More damaging. And so the argument is that, well, if you just have the trait and you live in a malaria-ridden area of the world, maybe 5 or 10% of the Earth's surface, you'll avoid malaria with just the, by having the trait. Here's my question.
Yeah.
I suspect that even the trait itself, that if you lived in even a malaria area and were asked, would you rather have the trait or not, I suspect that the real unbiased answer would be I'd rather not have the trait. So my question is, do you guys know whether or not the trait itself is more harmful than evolutionists want to admit?
Well, first of all, this was discussed in the last Creation Research Society Quarterly.
Yeah, we talked about this recently, and there is evidence that sickle cell, if you have the recessive part of the trait, so you don't have both genes from both parents, so you don't have sickle cell anemia, but you're essentially a carrier,
yes.
That there are detrimental effects of that. So it is a loss of genetic information.
And the editor of CRSQ, Kevin Anderson, PhD, he was in a debate, an email debate, with a Smithsonian evolutionist, Carl Zimmer, and it paralleled almost exactly a debate I had with atheists and evolutionists on Theology Online, and they desperately claim that sickle cell anemia trait, this is where your hemoglobin, your red blood cells, are not formed properly, so they can't carry oxygen properly. They insist that that is fabulous evidence for evolution. And the fact that they will take diseases and genetic breakdowns and say these are great evidence for evolution proves they do not have great evidence for evolution.
It's pretty desperate on their part. I've debated PhD scientists who use cancer as an example of evolution.
Of course.
And Fred, you make a great point because I've used this in debates in the past, is what would you rather have? Would you rather not have the sickle cell trait and get a van and move?
or
would you rather, have it so you don't get a malaria in a malaria-infested environment? Most people, unbiasedly, are going to say, hey, just give me a van and let me move out of here.
Yeah, so very good. Fred in Michigan, thank you so much for your call.
All right, and thank you, guys.
Really appreciate that. Now, Fred, if it's all right, let's go to another call. We're blowing off our emails, but, hey, we've got in Denver, Steve, welcome to Bob and Yurt Live.
I just had a question. I'm wondering with the light that comes to the Earth from stars that are even millions of light years away.
Okay.
How that's possible that we can see that if the Earth is only a few thousand years old.
Okay, that is a great question. And so, Steve, is there anything else, or you just want us to address that question?
No, I think that should do it.
Okay, all right. So, Fred Williams, you want to take a shot at it?
Sure. Okay, so the seeing light is probably the toughest question that we get. I've always been upfront about that. We don't have a 100% foolproof answer, but I can give you some of the ideas of what creationists have come up with. One has been from Dr. Russ Humphreys, who is a prominent scientist at Sandia Labs, and he proposed using Einstein's theory of relativity, when you use that, the effect of gravity on time, that there's a time dilation. I don't want to get into the technical aspects of this, but God could have used the theory of relativity to make light appear to us on day six, I don't have the time to go through it, but that's one idea. It's called white hole cosmology, if you get a chance to look it up on the Internet. Other ones are God created the light in transit in a mature creation. Now, other creationists have problems with that because that means, well, if a star explodes, then did it really never explode, but he just created the explosion? So there's different ideas out there, and we're working on that. But here's the interesting thing, Steve, is the speed of light problem is a lot worse for the evolutionists because there's a problem called, they call it the horizon problem. And the speed of light, what that problem entails is the temperature of the universe is the same everywhere. There isn't enough time in 20 billion years, the alleged age of the universe, for that to happen. You can only have just a small part of the universe have that much.
The CMB, the cosmic microwave background radiation of the universe,
exactly.
Whatever it is, 2.7 degrees Kelvin or whatever, it could not have come to that equilibrium.
Equilibrium is the word I was looking for.
In this short amount of time. And so the evolutionist will maybe make wild secondary and tertiary assumptions, which don't even qualify as scientific theories. And so how is it that the whole universe could be at the same background temperature? And so that is a massive problem. Now,
and it's
the Bible,
related. It's the same problem, really. It's a speed of light problem.
Yeah, speed of light
there
problem.
There hasn't been enough time for the universe to have that kind of equilibrium.
The Bible says, what is it? It more than 10 times by a number of different authors that God stretched out the heavens. He stretched out the heavens. So many creationists say when there was the creation occurring, it was supernatural. God did not create Adam and trees and the sun and the moon by natural processes. It was miraculous. And so how do you create a living human being out of dirt? Well, we can't do that, but God can. And so how does God create the universe and fill it with light? It is supernatural. The Bible says repeatedly he stretched out the heavens, and I believe that gives us some kind of insight into how he actually did it. He actually stretched out the galaxies and the universe and this and the light coming from those stars to fill the earth for the sake of man and his glory.
And we have powerful evidence that there's a stretching out, that God did this stretching out from our galaxy, because our galaxy is the center of the universe based on something called redshifts, on quantized redshifts. Because as you look out from our galaxy, galaxies tend to line up on a concentric circle. Like, imagine a dartboard, and as you go farther out, another concentric circle,
now,
you'll have
Steve,
galaxies lying along that. And so that's pointing to both the us being the center of the galaxy and also the stretching out effect that would have occurred from here.
So, hey, Steve?
Yes.
We were talking pretty quick there, but did you catch any of that, and do you have any thoughts?
No, I caught that. I'm just wondering, so it can be proven then that the Earth is at the center of the universe?
There is growing evidence.
That evidence is actually real powerful. If you do a search on quantized redshifts, and this is evidence that had been accumulated by evolutionists, and then creationists were taking note of it and, you know, writing, hey, wait a minute, what are you seeing here? It's also a powerful argument against the Big Bang, because with the Big Bang, you're not supposed to know that you're the center of
right.
the universe.
There wouldn't be a
there would
center.
Be, there would not be a center.
So quantized redshifts, you can Google that. And this is an area that Big Bang cosmologists are not going to enjoy.
No, it's powerful evidence against both the Big Bang and powerful evidence we are the center of the galaxy. It's really neat stuff. If you need it, if you can't find it, just email me at fred@evolutionfairytale.com and I'll get you the references for that.
All right, Steve?
Thank you very much.
Okay, appreciate that. Okay, Fred, so why don't we go to a question from email?
Sure.
All right. This here question you read earlier from Peter in Littleton, what would be the purpose of defense mechanisms before the fall? When God created, animals are not attacking one another. So venomous snakes and spiders and thorns and stickers and so on.
Okay. Well, we have some evidence, and we can start from the Bible, that God did make some changes biologically. For example, let's see, I've written down Genesis 3:18.
Yeah, why don't you read
let me
that
read
verse?
That. Let's see. Okay, I'm going to start from 17. To Adam, he said, because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat of it all the days of your life. And here's an important verse. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. So it producing thorns and thistles tells me that God made some kind of biological change to plants.
Okay, now why would that be? Well, God created man not on an island in space, but in the midst of an ecosystem. We were the pinnacle of the ecosystem on Earth, all these living creatures, and it all functions together. And God made it so that if we brought death into the cosmos, into the world, well, then that death would affect the plants growing on the earth, because the earth would not give us our sustenance. We would have to, with the sweat of our brow, we would have to work hard to survive. And because God is wise, if people are in rebellion, like an 18-year-old who is not obeying his parents, and you give him $1 million a year, what is that going to help him? It's going to hurt him. So God knew if we rebelled, that would bring death into the whole cosmos. In fact, it would break the cosmos.
That's right. And God created, you know, an ecosystem that is in really in remarkable balance. Bob and I were talking about this before the show. And you have examples, for example, when you put a predator into a lake, the fish will actually produce more eggs.
Yeah, they'll produce more eggs and they mature more more quickly.
Yeah, and I like the example you gave, Bob, about how the fish will actually... it's amazing.
I think my kids saw this, wasn't it, on some Nature Nova show or something a couple weeks ago. A fish will, when there's a predator in a lake, you introduce a predator, the certain kind of species, the female, will literally jump up out of the lake and land on low-hanging branches of a tree, and she'll lay her eggs on those branches. Then she'll flop back into the lake, and so that the predator can't get at the eggs, and then the male of the species will swim rapidly toward that branch and stop just under the surface of the water to splash the eggs. For 2 days he does that, because otherwise they would dry out and die. And then when they hatch, these little fish fall into the lake, and at least they can maybe avoid the predator by swimming. That is extraordinary design.
That is amazing. It's ecosystem
right
design at its most brilliant. And Bob, a thought that kind of came to my head is, you know, it sounds like to me, I'm not sure quite if that's how it is. I think maybe that Papa Fish didn't take out the trash, and
he
told Mama Fish to go jump out of the lake.
Go jump out of the lake. You're funny, Fred. All right, a last call. We only have 1 minute in Denver. Mike, welcome to Bob Inyart Live.
Hi.
Hi, Mike. You're on with Fred Williams and Bob Inyart.
Hey, I was just at the canyon, and they're still teaching that erosion theory.
The canyon? What, the Grand Canyon?
Yeah.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, when you look at the Grand Canyon from, say, the South Rim where the tourists stand, you see, as far as the eye can see, perfectly level, regular strata, which shows there were not millions of years of erosion while those strata were being laid down. They were laid down rapidly.
Well, not only that, one of the problems is that canyon is eroding by natural means, by water at that rate. All these side canyons that are just as deep with no water going down them.
Yeah, the side canyons,
the same depth.
Right? The side canyons are inexplicable. Plus, it eroded uphill. It doesn't work.
They're going the wrong direction too.
Right.
Hey, the question I had is: I heard a theory purported by that you can't even prove the Earth is spinning.
You cannot prove the Earth
is... the amount of speculation necessary, even with the spacecraft out there yet.
Yeah.
Have you heard that one before?
Yeah, the whole universe is actually spinning once every 24 hours, and the Earth is still. No, that's ridiculous.
I have heard that theory myself.
We're out of time, though, Mike. Thanks so much
for
calling. So, Fred, we are out of time, but thanks for joining me.
Yeah, this was great.
Super.
Have to do it again.
April 12th, Colorado Springs. April 25th at the Capitol. See you there. And Maranatha, what a great school, Maranatha.